Welcome to episode 167 of the Guy at the Movies podcast. Once again, joined from the man of the future, Nick. How are you?
As always, the future is still shit, Joe. But we're alive and we're thriving and we're watching movies. And that's, you know what? Maybe it's not as shit as we thought it was.
Can you just tell me, is a disgraced congressman, former congressman, George Santos, making any waves over there in Australia in the future? Because I'm pretty sure he's going to pop up on like RuPaul's Drag Race or something soon.
Well, all I know about the situation is that he there was some trouble with the fact that he was using funds from campaigns on OnlyFans accounts, yeah. Which in Australia would be a very, very, we wouldn't be too mad at our politicians doing that, but I think there's some other things going on with little Georgie that are that might be a little more scandalous than that. But that's little what the headline was here.
Yeah, little Georgie gave an interview last week or something, or maybe when the ethics report first came out. I think that was 2 weeks ago at this point, and was like, I just learned what OnlyFans was the other day from a discussion in my office. I'm like, what are you talking about in your office?
It's like, firstly, is this an appropriate workplace conversation? And secondly, you know that thing that people are earning millions of dollars on and you don't know what it is?
Right.
George.
Yeah, come on, buddy. It's driving the economy right now, buddy. So special.
I'm excited for Guy at the Movies to launch OnlyFans exclusive podcast, right? That's Please. The next step, right?
Yeah. that's in the works. Stay tuned. Once again, American politics doing the most to be considered the least. Here we are. What's going on your end, Nick? What's happening up there? What's happening in the future there?
In the future, down under, there's a little bit going on, actually. I think the biggest thing that is going to eventually come out stateside in the future is the biggest thing that obviously happened this week was the Furiosa trailer dropped, right? And everyone got so keen about it. And being an Australian production, we were so excited about it. But Chris Hemsworth, he's getting in a bit of trouble, actually, for it. And I think Chris Hemsworth might be getting cancelled because of some prosthetic nose wear he's wearing, because unfortunately people want to cancel him because then he's making fun of Bradley Cooper in Maestro. That's what came out, is that Chris Hemsworth has been cancelled for making fun of Bradley Cooper's nose prosthetics in Maestro. It's a horrible story, and if Chris can come back from it, he can, that bully to him. But that's not looking good for Mr. Hemsworth there at this point in time.
I gotta tell you, I was so surprised that was him. I watched the trailer maybe twice, and each time I'm like, that is him, right? That is Chris Hemsworth.
We were shocked too, because he's using his Australian accent in a film. We were like, wait, you have one of those still? So that was that was shocking to us. But there's another piece of news that's going to drop as well, because I think the surprise release of this weekend was Godzilla Minus One, right? It's doing gangbusters. Everyone's super excited about it. But in classic Hollywood fashion, they're already looking at doing a Hollywood adaptation of Godzilla Minus One. And they've already announced a string of sequels. So they've got Godzilla Minus One, the remake, and then Godzilla Plus One, Godzilla Divide One, Godzilla Multiply One, and they've actually got Ed Sheeran doing the motion capture for Godzilla. But we only know that in Australia because we're in the future. That news will be coming to the States very soon, but that's the scoop. That's the Aussie scoop for you.
Excellent news. Ed Sheeran wanted to hit the big screen after his buddy Taylor Swift dominated the screens over here. So.
Exactly. That's right. And I hope these stories end up on Discussing Film, because they're genuinely real stories. Let's not forget that.
Oh my gosh. Called out there. Love that. Yeah, I need to see that Godzilla Minus One.
Same. I haven't watched it yet. I've heard it's amazing.
People are loving it. Loving it. That might be on the docket for later today. Who knows? We'll see what happens there. Awesome, Nick. Well, we always love to get a little heads up on what we're going to be dealing with in about 12 hours. So thank you so much for that.
You're more than welcome.
Let's dive into what we've been. Well, let's start with trailers, actually. And you mentioned the Furiosa trailer. And I'm very interested to hear your reaction. And I think definitely, getting tipped off a little bit that the fact that it is an Aussie production, and of course, with Chris Hemsworth in there and Anya Taylor-Joy really stepping into a very dominant role here. What were your thoughts in that the trailer that got released, I think, 2 days ago now?
Yeah, it's a couple of days ago. So, I'm excited based on the fact that I loved Fury Road. I think that's what a lot of the hype going into this has been like, this is like the Fury Road sequel we want.
Yeah.
The most noticeable aspect was it definitely looks like there's a lot more CGI than I think people intended. And I wasn't too turned off by that because my defense would be, remember, this is the trailer. They still have like 7 months or so to like work on this film and refine everything and make it look great. And let's remember how great the visual effects were in Fury Road too, that mixture. So I know there's a hesitancy, and I won't lie, if like I had that initially, but I had to talk myself down from that ledge, being like, it's not going to look too terrible come release in May. I thought Anya Taylor-Joy looked fantastic. Like she's just having a killer time in cinema at the moment. And I think this, like her opportunity to do like an action role, will solidify her in a sense of she's a very sort of genre based actor, which is great. And then obviously, as we joked about before, Chris Hemsworth, I kind of like the idea that he's going to be a little bit more unhinged and sort of break free from like just the naturally good looking, charismatic, relying on your own sort of charisma sort of actor, and do something a little bit kind of quirky in that true George Miller fashion. So there's a lot that I really enjoyed about the trailer. What the story is, I have no idea. Fury Road, same thing. Like, what was really the story of that? But it was still a great, great movie. So hopefully, I feel like at this point, I'm at the place where I'm like, Furiosa could be lightning striking twice. So I'm pretty keen for it. Well, what do you reckon? What do you think?
You know, it's funny because when you talk about the story, I think the same. I was like, okay, so she's trying to find her way home, but obviously this is a prequel, so we sort of know how things go in a way. It looked a lot like Fury Road in many ways. I did catch the CGI. I'm right there with you. There were certain aspects of the trailer that didn't wow me there, but you're right. They do have a lot of time. I don't know. It's funny because I was debating this with a friend the other day, and he was like, oh, you're not a big Fury Road fan or a big Mad Max fan? And I said, not that I'm not a big fan. I just don't know that I need this movie. I'm excited for everyone involved. Don't get me wrong. But to me, it looks like more of the same. And
yes. Yeah.
I'm kind of, I don't know. I'm indifferent. I mean, he has a proven track record, and the people that are involved are solid. And I'm very excited to see Chris Hemsworth kind of like, you know, out of that pretty boy status in whether it's Thor or any of the other films that he's been doing, like the big blockbusters, thinking about like Ghostbusters in 2016, you know,
even Extraction and things like that, right? Where he's kind of like that. It's a bit one note, right? Like, yeah.
He looks the same. He acts the same in a lot of ways, whether it's, I mean, totally. Serious to humorous, but this is just completely out of his box, which I'm very excited for. And again, Anya Taylor-Joy is just, she knocks everything out of the park. She's a great young actress. So I'm intrigued. But the trailer was just very odd. Like the writing and such, like as they were giving you the backstory, I'm like, this, what are we doing here? This is a very odd trailer.
It felt in a weird way, though. It kind of felt very George Miller to me. Such a grandiose filmmaker. And did you see 3,000 Years of Longing last year?
Oh yes.
Did you like it? Like, because I really enjoyed it, but I understand its reception wasn't great.
Yes, I like a lot of it. I'm like mid on it. I thought that it I didn't think it stuck the landing, but there's a lot of things that I like about it.
And the visuals of that movie are like standout, right? And it's another CGI heavy film, which kind of makes me go, okay, is he going to make it look, you know, not like a video game, not like a cartoon? And I think that's kind of great. And it's funny you mentioned being a fan of the series, because like I don't love the original Mad Max trilogy, which might revoke my citizenship here in Australia, being like their cultural icons. I love Fury Road, though. Like, I think Fury Road is a masterful action film, but I'm not a Mad Max lore fan, right? So I think for me, this is kind of like my second Mad Max movie, and that's probably why I'm keen for it, as opposed to being the fifth Mad Max film, which it honestly is. So, come May, we'll see what happens. Like, I just think, it seems like it's unique enough to at least be like, it's not like other action films.
I kind of forgot that it existed until they announced that the trailer was being dropped the other day. I'm like, oh yeah, this is happening.
I was reading up about it all before the show and stuff, and I was like, I completely forgot he wanted to make Fury Road in the 90s. Even earlier than that, I think. And then he wanted to make when Fury Road was coming about, he wanted to do a Furiosa sequel straight away, like even before they. So this has been on his mind for such a long time, but
yeah,
proof of the yeah. pudding will be in magic.
Should be interesting. I think that he has such goodwill with moviegoers that it's yes. probably going to do very well.
Yes.
And I think the cast as well is pretty charming.
Yes, charming. And there's some great like Australian character actors in there as well. Like nice. There's some cool performances coming.
I have a question. So speaking yes. of Aussie films, and I'm thinking about like what's been out recently, and this is on my mind because I just saw The Iron Claw the other day. What was your thoughts on Gold? Remember Gold, the movie that
Zac Efron film?
Yeah.
I don't really remember it. I remember, however, I do remember thinking Zac Efron's performance was great in it. Yeah. And yeah. I feel like that was the movie that sort of broke the mold for him a little bit. It was kind of like he was going into his, for lack of a better comparison, like Robert Pattinson phase, right? Where it's like, I'm breaking free of what my foundations were.
Wow. I don't know if you realize you just made a High School Musical reference in that.
I just say Breaking Free, right?
Nailed it.
It's deep in here. That's why it's deep in here. But I remember his performance being good. I remember the movie looking great, but I remember the movie being also like a little bit paper thin for like what it was trying to do. Iron Claw doesn't come out in Australia till like mid-January. I'm so fucking bummed about that because that is the one movie I won't see before the end of the year. That and The Color Purple will be the two movies I don't see before the end of the year that like I want to be in my 2023 lists or at least have a chance for that list there. So, but Zac Efron to me in Gold, I was like, dude, you can act. Like you are a good actor.
That's exactly what I took away from it. And especially, you know, not getting into The Iron Claw, but Zac Efron is phenomenal in it. His performance is great. And I reference Gold as, again, similar to what you just said, the film where he really broke out of that mold. And you can see that he's taking roles that are challenging him. And it's nice to see someone who started out as, you know, High School Musical Disney star. And then was typecast in, 17 again? And, you know, all the tween movies, if you will.
All of them, yeah.
Yeah, and is now doing good things. So, I remember watching Gold and being like, man, this boy can act.
Yeah, and then the other one, the greatest beer run on earth that he did last year as well. Like, movie, again, not entirely great, but different. And Zac Efron kind of thrived in that role too. So, I'm so excited for The Iron Claw. Like, that just screams. And I love Sean Durkin films. Like, I think. Like to say you love his films is kind of like, are you a sad person?
Yes. It's funny because I often talk about slice of life films, which are like more, you know, I think we talked about it probably on the last podcast, actually. Movies that just really focus on like real things and real life issues and give that time to develop on film. And I think Sean Durkin does that as well, whether it's a story about, whether it's an original story or a story focused on a family that thinks they're cursed in wrestling, you know? it's pretty wild. The other trailer that dropped was actually the second trailer for Night Swim. And I'm just, I keep describing it as like horror in a swimming pool, and I'm very pumped for it. But what did you think of Night Swim?
I watched the trailer once simply because like I already know I'm going to be excited. I'm kind of excited for this movie anyway, mainly just because of the premise. Like you said, it's a horror movie in a swimming pool. Like I just want to know how this is going to get pulled off. And the fact that it's kind of like, it's not necessarily the pool that's the problem, but it's like what's in the pool is the problem. Like I remember as a kid, I was always told that the little flap that goes into the filter was like, never put your hand in there. Don't do like it'll fucking tear your hands off. Like these are the horror stories we're told in Australia. And now I have a movie that's going to be about this core childhood fear. I'm like, I'm excited to face this fear. But the cast in it's great too. Like Kerry Condon, Wyatt Russell. Like this is a good cast, and it's Blumhouse. I'm pretty favorable to their film, so it seems absurd, but I'm excited for it.
I'm on this original horror kick where I'm like, release anything and everything because I'm really into it. Like whether it's shit or not, like I'm just excited that they're giving the space for these new stories to be told.
And
it's
like funny, weird concepts, right? Like, yeah,
absolutely. I wonder if this was born out of Barb dying in Stranger Things in season one. That was my first thought. I'm excited for this because it reminds me of, like, one of the reasons I hate swimming in the ocean is because when the water is not clear, you don't know what's under there. And that's what this reminds me of a little bit.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like, what lurks in the deep is like, best not to know.
Yeah.
Best not to know. Do you know what does lurk in the deep? The Meg 2. That's what lurks in the deep.
Yeah.
And that's scary.
Yeah, that died at the bottom of the ocean. That was rough.
And it's coming back up into your swimming pools.
My gosh.
To take your souls and your box office and your money.
Oh, God. They tried so hard with that
movie.
They
tried so hard.
Oh, what a shame, because the first one I enjoyed.
I love the and I love the poster for Night Swim too. Like that, the swimming pool and like the blood coming up from the bottom. Like that to me like screams 70s, 80s horror, where, like you said, these weird concepts are just, they're throwing everything at the wall and whatever hits it and you enjoy, they're like, yeah, that's what we totally intended from the start.
Very much love it. Very much and interested.
Megan or Mithrigan, whatever you want to call it, had that same release date earlier this year, and that was the box office surprise. I liked that movie. I didn't love it, but I understand that everyone, like, there's a big fan base for that film. Could Night Swim be that other solidifying fact that, like, January horror is kind of a moneymaker for the studios?
And they moved it up 2 weeks in the States to January 4th. Yeah. So
it did. No, it got moved up here. I think it's like a New Year's Day maybe here or something as well. Okay. I know we got early words about maybe seeing it this year. So,
wow, man, I love that Night Swim is making a splash, if you will. that's terrible. Bye. And that's all we have today. All right, let's get into what we've been watching. I want to start off with Bottoms, because this is a movie that came out in the States over the summer. Yeah, August. And you just saw it the other day, but I want to get your reaction, because I saw a comment, maybe it was on Letterboxd or Instagram, but you basically were just like talking about how ridiculous it was, and I'm so anxious to hear your thoughts on this movie, because I thought I had so much fun with it because is ridiculous.
and that's exactly what I meant. Like, I think literally all I wrote on Letterboxd was that was fucking nuts. And it was like, it was just like right from minute one, when it's Rachel Sennett and Ayo Edebiri like just talking in the bedroom, and they're just basically, it's like, to me it was like the American Pie thing where it's like, we just want to get laid, that's all they're talking about. And I was like, okay, cool, we got the teen sex comedy, it's making a comeback in a non-problematic way, like let's have some fun with this. And it just went, for me it went from like strength to strength with the comedy. And the biggest thing that is so funny about it is that it takes every high school trope and click and amplifies it to 1,000. Like I thought every character was perfectly written. For like, I wouldn't even call it, it's satire, but I wouldn't even call it satire. It's like just, it's like if Saturday Night Live did a high school movie, but did it really, really well. You know what I mean? Like they just because I think Rachel Sennett and Emma Seligman wrote the screenplay, right? So they, to me, went just like, what? Let's take every facet of high school and like, how insane can we make it? And they go for it. And the biggest one, the biggest laugh that came out of me, and it was in the most random bit, is in the cafeteria when Jeff, Jeff had me dying in every scene, but you find out he's allergic to pineapple, and he throws the fruit salad and it hits the emo kid, and he goes, fine, that's the last straw, you'll all regret this, and he writes how to blow up a school on his notepad. And I lost it, because to me that is just exactly, it's like, of course the turning point for, and it's like an interesting commentary on like violence, school violence, right? That the fact that he just had a fruit salad thrown onto his it's so ridiculous, and it's done so well, and nothing was off limits. I think I appreciated that. There's jokes about the violence in schools, there's jokes about homophobia, jokes about feminism, jokes about masculinity, jokes about race, jokes about gender, like nothing is off, jokes about eating disorders, like nothing's off limits, but it's all coming from a place of like, you guys know this is fucking stupid, right? Like to even be like worrying about this in high school. I thought it was really fun, and I think the script is a lot smarter than people probably in expecting it to be going in, because I walked away going, that was ridiculous, but it didn't really get anything wrong with the high school experience, no matter how stupid it gets.
It's like a very smart, not another teen movie from back in the day.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, which again is a really funny movie, but yeah, for a different reason. Like, that is the SNL skit, right?
Absolutely.
Whereas like Bottoms is the SNL skit humor, but done with like a really smart, sincere lens, for sure.
And great acting. I thought Rachel Sennott and Ioita Berry were just incredible. Like, they're back and forth. And there was it's funny because I'm part of a Gallica critics group, and they, I don't know if they like saw the writing on the wall with the strike coming, but we screened this very early. And did a press conference, if you will, with the two of them and Emma Seligman. And it was just really good. Like, even just watching them interact, talking about the movie gave me such like excitement to watch it again, because they just had great chemistry. The jokes were landing every turn. And you can also tell that like Emma Seligman and Rachel Sennott, who co-wrote this, I believe, just like in lockstep. Like, they have a very good take on what works in comedy, and it's exciting to see, especially like starting with Shiva Baby and coming to this.
God,
and
I love that movie.
I can't wait to see what's next for them, because Bottoms blew me away. Like, I had so much fun with it. I don't remember laughing at a movie quite that much in quite a long time.
That is my only downside, and it's not the movie's fault, but I just, because again, it was actually not getting a theater release here at all. And I genuinely think with the strikes and everything getting pushed, that they were just like, all right, well, let's just put it in cinemas. I think it was supposed to just be an Amazon Prime release here, because MGM now have that contract and whatnot. But regardless of that, I just happened to see it at like 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, you know, when everyone's going to the cinema. So it was me and one other person, and I'm towards the front of the cinema sort of person. I like making the screen as big as possible. So I'm always already sitting away from the only other person in the cinema, and I could only hear me laughing for the whole, you know what I mean? Like, I would have loved to have seen this in with a crowd, or at least a handful of people who would like going to enjoy it in the same level I am. So that's my only downside, is like I had so much fun and it is funny, but I think the laughs that would have come from an audience in this film would have just been astronomical and just sort of taken it to that next level for me. But I think my sort of comedy that I like is not just smart comedy, but comedy that isn't afraid to make fun of everything without offending anyone. Like, that's the key. You're not being mean about anything. It's just, like, it's a very Australian thing. It's just taking the piss out of something. Like, we don't have to be so serious about everything, as long as it's not being hurtful to people. And I think Bottoms is a really good example of that. Because like I said, it is not scared to take anything head on and just put it through this ridiculously heightened high school lens, especially the final 15 minutes of this movie, which is, I did not see that coming at all. The reveal of the plot of what this high school football team are doing, I was like, that's hilarious, first of all. And then, of course, with what it is, and you had to make a semen joke in there as well, which had me in stitches. But then where it leads to, and then just the resolution of the film, it's like, oh yeah, look around, look what just happened. Well, yeah, I guess that's just high school. Like, it's great. And I'm the same. I cannot wait to see what Rachel Sennott and MS Seligman do next, because in a similar vein, Bodies, Bodies, Bodies.
Yes,
was like Rachel Sennott was the highlight, and that's where I was like, oh, she's a comedy genius.
She was a brave. I actually, someone just asked me last night about that, and they were like, did you see that movie, the A24 horror, blah blah blah? And I like went off about Rachel Sennott. I'm like, oh, she steals the show, and
that's part of the movie.
I'm also loving that Nicholas Galitzine had a really fascinating summer with the release of, like, you know, in one movie, in Red, White, and Royal Blue, he's playing like the sexy gay prince of England. Yeah. And then in this, he's playing like dumb idiot jock, you know.
It's so Jeff. Good. I love dumb idiot jock Jeff, but I also love that they were like, play him a little gay though. Like, that I love that. Absolutely. But he leaned into it so well. Like, it kind of like reminded me of like a Labrador. Like, it's sincerely stupid. You know what I mean? Like, he wasn't just sitting there going like, duh.
Yeah.
It was like genuinely like, oh, you are a dumb guy. Like, it was great, but he does it so well. And his reactions to just anything, the opening when he gets in quotations hit by the car at the beginning, Oh my god. And his friend coming and holding him, like screaming up to God, like, why would you do that? Like, it's great. Yeah, it's and I love that he's on crutches for like 10 minutes. He's just, I could watch this movie again. It is so damn funny. And Aya Edebiri is just, oh my God, I am in love with her. And she is just strength to strength. I think the first thing I saw him was The Bear. I think, like, for most people, that would have been like a breakout, right?
Yeah. I was going to say, like, thinking about her, what's the word, sternness, her, the way that she presents herself in The Bear, totally, and then seeing her in something like this, you're like, oh, she has dynamic range.
Oh god, yeah. And that's is exactly right. Like, her character in The Bear needs to be that. She's an up-and-coming chef who wants to work for a Michelin star chef. Like, it's kind of gonna have this sort of really methodical, pedantic nature. Then she does this and she's great. Then she's voicing April O'Neil in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which she's having an absolute blast with as well. And Theater Camp. She is so funny in Theater Camp. Like, she's just that carefree, loose, like, I don't know what I'm doing here. I'm just getting paid. And that comedy in Theater Camp when she's doing that, the defense, the combat theater class, to me, I was like, oh shit, you're really funny. And obviously knowing Bottoms was coming out, I was like, I can't wait to see what you do in Bottoms after that. So
criminally underused though in
Shit, yeah, god, yeah. But that was that's the Ben Platt, Molly Gordon vehicle sort of thing for you for you as well.
I'm looking at her IMDb to see what's coming up, and there's a few things. She's also listed as being in Marvel's Thunderbolts.
Is there a character next to
no character assigned.
Staying within the Disney wheelhouse.
All right. Well, I don't want you to think that I am ignoring the fact that you said you sit at the front of the theater, Nick. What is going on with you?
A couple rows back. Two reasons. I like the screen to be as big as possible, and I don't mind kind of like, there's enough cinemas that have reclining chairs now that you can really climb back and be like, wow. I did not by choice, but I did end up watching Hunger Games: Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes in the front row because I rocked up late to the screening. That one was a bit tougher. But I like being away from people. I don't like, in this modern age of like, you're probably going to go on your phone and you're probably going to start talking to the people around you. Like, I don't want to be around that because firstly, I do tell people to shut up in cinemas, but I don't always do it nicely and it's not intentional, but like, I'm very much like, I'll be watching, and if I hear you talk once, I'm kind of like, I'm going to let that one slide. And by the second time, I'm turning around, and I've literally said something before. It's like, I'm paid to watch a movie, not listen to you talk. Shut up.
You go vocal right away.
I go vocal, yeah.
I just do the...
I feel like... And you know what? If it works, it works. It does. But I'm like a lay down the law sort of guy. So I'm just like... And I can't really use the I've paid to watch this movie line anymore, unfortunately, because I'm also telling people in media screenings to shut up. But
that's also the worst, right? When you're there with other critics and stuff, you're like, hello, like, stop. This is not a time to have a discussion about a film.
It's the worst. And like, because now, especially with some big releases, you have, I don't know if it's the same in our Philly way, but like, you have security at some screenings looking for phones and stuff. Yeah. And they'll look out for phones and no one pulls out their phones, but they don't tell people to be quiet, and that's probably not their directive. So like, I've just like taken the mantle of being like, shut the fuck up. Like, you're not cast in this film unless if your name is on the credits and this is a 4D experience and you're my surround sound, go for it. But that's not the case. So shut the fuck up.
I have a friend who, I'm trying to remember what movie it was. I want to say it was one of the Star Wars movies, the latest trilogy. He gets so mad when people are talking, and literally like during a movie he got up, he looked, someone was talking over and over again, he just went just stared at them. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're gonna get into a fight here. But he's like, what is going on?
that's a step further than me. That's like that's asserting dominance over the theater. Everyone else then goes like, oh shit, like, I'm not gonna
And the funny thing is, he's like 5'4", 5'5". He's like a very small, built dude, but very small dude. Yeah. And I'm like, oh boy. But
sometimes that's scarier when you got that pit bull energy. You kind of, that's a little scarier, to be honest. But that's why I sit towards the front now, because people now electively sit towards the back. And I'm like, if I'm not around people, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I'm a back guy. I'm always like the last, second, not the last row, because in some of the theaters around here, the last row is the smallest row.
And your knees are up into your chest. Yeah,
not into that. I mean, it's changed now with recliners and stuff, it's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's typically my go-to, except the last time I sat in the front row was Hostel back in the day.
Oh god, that's fucking over almost 20 years ago.
And it was a rough one to sit in the front row. I'm like,
you're looking up and then you're kind of getting vertigo from that, and then you're seeing people's Achilles getting ripped off. You're like, oh god, this is disgusting.
That is the scene that came to mind right away. I can't do foot stuff. Like, as soon as you go after a foot, like it happened in House of Wax, it did that.
House of Wax,
I can't do it.
That's so funny. Out of all the gory shit, because I know we're both unapologetically fans of the Saw franchise.
Absolutely.
Anything with feet or ankles is my, like, nut. I'm like, I got to know out of that.
I'm like, suck the guy's eye out, I'm fine. Like, burn her alive, totally cool with that. Touch the foot, I'm done. Done.
At least my girlfriend can sleep well now, knowing I don't have a foot thing. Like, that's like, I'm so far removed from feet that it's just, whether it's sexual or torture, I'm not a foot guy.
Well, we're talking about OnlyFans. There's a lot of money to be made with feet.
That's it. I'm not saying I'm not taking pictures of other people's. No, anyway.
That's what you're doing in the front row of theaters.
That's what I'm doing in the front row. Just sneak behind.
Excuse me, can you take your shoe off?
I'll let you talk through the movie if you let me take a photo of your feet.
Oh my god, no free feet. All right. Let's talk about the other film that you saw recently. That is, I actually don't believe that Sean and I had talked about it on the podcast. Okay. But this is The Holdovers. I saw this. Did I see this at the Philadelphia Film Festival? Regardless, it's one of my favorite movies of the year. Paul Giamatti acts the shit out of this movie. I think it's his best performance, in my opinion. And you also have Daphne Randolph Joy.
Devine.
Yep. Who is phenomenal and just won the New York Film Critics Award for Best Supporting Actress.
Yes.
But I think that the one that really blew me away was the young kid in this, Dominic Sessa. Yeah. Because this is his first role. And he is incredible. I do think that this is the quintessential holiday movie that we've been looking for years. It has such a good message and such good intentions. And it's just very, very, very well directed by Alexander Payne.
I agree. I was lucky enough to see this because it's not coming out in Australia until mid-January as well. So we do this thing in Australia where if there's anything that's awards contender, we wait for it to win a couple of awards, wait for it to get nominated for an Oscar, then it comes out in cinemas and they'll go Academy Award nominated film, and people go, oh, I want to see that. And it works on us. It works every year because it hasn't changed since I've been alive. So, but I was lucky enough to see it because there's an international rollout happening for it. And I fell in love with it right from the first few minutes. I was just absolutely on board. And I know there was a few people's early reactions, like it felt like a warm hug of a movie. And I totally get that. I get the feeling that they're trying to say. I would say it's more sentimental. I think it's a very sentimental sort of movie. It has this incredible aesthetic of like a 1970s comedy, and not just the fact that it has this film. I was only learned today it was filmed on digital and then had the film grain added post-production, which it looks uncanny. Like, you would assume it was shot on film, but the comedic styling, the acting, the way the film's edited and shot does feel like a film from the 70s and the 80s. It just has, there's certain scenes that might linger a little too long. There's not a stillness, but there's like a stillness is absolutely the wrong word. There's a over the top nature to some of the performances too.
Yeah.
And I think Dominic Sessa is a good example of that in the beginning. He's like a cocky high school kid who's a bit of the class clown, but he's also a smart kid. And he has a few lines of dialogue that really showcase that in that very like, hey man, I'm a cool high school kid. You know what I mean? Like that sort of nature to it. But as the movie goes on and it becomes like more of an actual Christmas film, that sentimental feeling grows stronger and stronger as the relationship grows stronger and stronger. And I just think the comedic timing of both Dominic Sessa and Paul Giamatti is fantastic. Yeah. Like there are some genuinely laugh out loud moments in this movie, and the movie's funny till it's not. And then when it's not funny, it's really touching and really, I feel like it's equally heartwarming and heartbreaking with some of the things, especially stuff with Devine's character, who's a grieving mother and whatnot. And you find out more about Paul Giamatti's character's life and sort of, you know, it's very obvious early on that he has a problem with alcohol as well. And it's sort of how that plays out throughout the film. So it's funny, but then at some points it'll just like genuinely, like kind of pull at your heart a little bit. And then obviously I tweeted my reaction and you DM'd me and were like, what were you talking about when you said it was like one of the greatest film insults? And I was like, that line that's towards the end of the film, I was in hysterics because it's perfect. It's a great arc for Giamatti's character. And then who he's saying it to is the perfect recipient for that insult. But it is just, it's just a very sentimental movie without having like much in common with the characters. I think to be able to put that feeling across is quite a remarkable feat for Alexander Payne. And I genuinely think this has become like a common rotation in my Christmas watches, because immediately I wanted to show it to my partner and my family and her family over Christmas and stuff. So
yeah,
I hope I get the opportunity to do that.
You know, it's funny because I think that any filmmaker that can balance the humor with the depth of the story they're telling and the depth of the characters that they're exploring is talented. And I think Payne does this very well with each of these characters and gives them each the time to have their story, you know, take center stage. I completely butchered her name, but I want to again clarify Devine Joy Randolph, yes, who was just, like you said, phenomenal with her story of loss. Oh, and when you get to Giamatti's backstory and even like diving into a little bit more Dominic Sessa, and it all kind of comes to a head when his parents visit the school later on in the film. I don't know. This is a warm hug. It feels like something that's said a lot about movies that are comforting and fun. But I think that it just was very, I wouldn't even say real, but it surprised me. I didn't expect to be touched as much as I was by the holdovers.
I think sincere is probably what I would, like a word I would say. It just seems like a film that's very much so made from the heart. So even if at times it does feel, even the emotional aspects do feel like a little bit heightened and not necessarily like it plays into sort of the conventions of the film and the tropes of the film a little bit, it still feels like it's coming from a really nice place. And I think that's what people are really like resonating with. And that's not easy to do, because you can either then get melodramatic and it doesn't work, or you get insincere and you kind of go, well, that movie's like emotionally manipulating me. The Holdovers does not feel like that at all. It is just the perfect balance. And I think another aspect that works really well is that it's a movie that I believe it's R, right, in the States. And it's because there's a bit of swearing, like, but it's not like heaps of it. But there was enough for me to be like, this is just how people talk.
Absolutely.
Like, these are all high school. These are all boys boarding school. Of course, they're going to call each other fuckheads and fuckwads and stuff like that. Like, and it's really, when he gets left the photo and it says fuckwad on it, I laughed. It's an awful moment because he's getting called a fuckwad. But I haven't heard that word in so long. And I was like, that's funny to me. But it's those use of those words, and like occasionally, like they have weed to smoke and stuff like that, to me is kind of like, I don't know how senses
real
get about that, but it's real, right? It's kind of like we were all teenage boys once. We all speak, some of us still speak like that. And it just, to me, I felt like even though I'm not in the character, in Dominic Sessa's character's situation, I understand what he's going through. And then at aspects, you understand what Paul Giamatti's character is going through and the way he, and that, like you said, that performance is so good. I agree. I think it's his best performance ever, and I genuinely hope he gets a chat come Oscar time.
Yeah, I agree with that. I keep going back to Dominic Sessa, because this being his first role and the way that he was able to carry his moments of his character's exploration and just to go blow for blow with Giamatti is right? Just incredible. I was blown away. I had to double check that after I left the movie. I'm like, was this really his first movie?
And that's what makes their final scene so powerful. Yeah, like that's absolutely why the end of the movie is so, I don't want to say, I'll say it's good, and yeah, I won't say it's necessarily like uplifting, but it's a fantastic ending for this story. And those two, like, you know, it's the age of like show don't tell. Like that's what is so good about that end scene. So yeah, I loved this it
again today.
I know, and like I know it just came. I think it just came out on digital, there, right? So it's kind of like, I'm not suggesting, but Australians, you have a chance to watch it over Christmas somehow. I would wait for the cinema because I generally would wait for cinemas though, because like that the 70s style aesthetic looked amazing on the big screen. And the soundtrack, like the audio, was recorded in mono. So actually all the sound comes from the front of the speakers. So it has this kind of, not in a bad way, but this like tinny sound to it. And it's great. It, like I said, it adds that nostalgia and adds that sentimentality. But it's going to be in my top movies of the year, without a doubt.
Definitely. And the sound, I was thinking about this, is very transformative. Mm. Like it takes you into the time, which was just, it was perfect. That was a perfect piece of the film.
Might be Alexander Payne's best movie too. And that's saying, that's big because he's got Sideways. He's got The Descendants. Like,
I think so. But everyone keeps saying, oh, well, Sideways. And I'm like, Sideways is great, but Sideways is great. Different.
It's completely different to, I think, anything he's ever made. Yeah. To be totally honest. And then I think he's really found like a style of movie. He's, I would almost say, perfected.
Yeah.
There's like one or two things in the movie that I'm like, sure, that like it's not going to make it a 5-star movie, but maybe on rewatch I could be there and be like, shit, this could be a 5-star movie.
I don't even remember what I settled on. I think I did 4.5.
I did 4.5. So yeah.
All right, let's get into some of the news. And this is news that continues to reverberate around the industry. And this actually happened about a week ago here. But this was Melissa Barrera from the Scream films, most recently Scream 6 this past year, was fired from Scream 7. And this was due to posts about the Israel-Hamas war. Basically, the company behind the film, Spyglass Media, took issue with the way that she was posting a number of things that were comparing what's happening to concentration camps, genocide, ethnic cleansing, and such. The Spyglass came out and basically said that they had zero tolerance for anti-Semitism or the incitement of hate in any form. But of course, this has the fan base completely divided. Well, I wouldn't even say divided. I think a lot of the fan base is all on the same page and up in arms about what's going on. And just, I believe it was yesterday, there were over 1,000 industry individuals, including the likes of Olivia Colman, signed a note, if you will, condemning the firing of Barrera, among other censorship steps that have been taken seen as censorship. And right after this, Jenna Ortega, the news broke that she wasn't returning. A lot of people kind of conflated this and said that it was because of Melissa Barrera, but this had been rumored for months that she wasn't going to be in this film.
Those stories had been around for so long. And the reason that they gave did align with the reason, which was the Wednesday shooting Wednesday schedule show for season two, right? So, and you know what? We're not in Hollywood, whether it is or is not, but the story is lining up. Like that is, you know, it's not hard. It's harder to argue against it when there is a bit of a fucking paper trail there as well. So, but that's the thing. But yeah, this, like you said, I don't think it's, that definitely hasn't divided the fan base. And now that all the chat is around rebooting Scream, you know, and it's a franchise now that has 6 movies, that has a pretty consistent, if not storyline, consistent characters throughout. Like, where do you go now? And you've got a new director in Christopher Landon, and you know, now your 2 main stars, who there was a rumored, again, the buzzword has been around, is rumored trilogy for the Carpenter sisters. Is it the Carpenter sisters? Is that their name?
Yes.
In the film. So, but that to me is kind of the lower priority of the issue, right? And that's the biggest thing that comes out of it is like what the comments were and what the intention and the context behind the comments were, whether that should have led to her firing or not.
Yeah.
And whether it is a comparable sort of thing, there's all the commentary about Noah Schnapp and what he, his the designism is sexy sort of, again, this is my ignorance to it. Like, I know enough about it, but I don't know enough about it. The, you know, that there's been backlash, but not within the industry for it as well. So you kind of sit there and go like, what is, you know, is there a line that needs to be drawn? And what is it? But that's the biggest question, isn't it? It's like, sure, we could have a line, but then where is the line? And then are you stopping people from saying their views? And we spoke about this offline. We've spoken about it for the last 2 weeks in the sense of, and you said it in our text, was like, it's not necessarily having the ability to say what you want is the problem. It's when you do say things that are hurtful and you say things that are factually incorrect. That's where the problem therefore lies as well.
Yeah. So I was diving into this a lot because it was, you know, it's freedom of speech is all the buzz in America here.
Yes.
And it's what she was doing in a sense, and this isn't defending Spyglass at all. And this isn't, you know, berating her, but she was acting as one of those social media individuals who just reposts everything without really diving deeper into it. So it's true that she was sharing things on like every side of this terrible situation.
Yeah, totally,
But she, I think at some point when you have a million followers that you have a social responsibility, and some of the stuff that she was putting out there was factually inaccurate. Now, here's diving deeper into this as well. You do not fire the franchise, the current franchise star who has been part of the revitalization of a storied franchise, Scream, over the past couple of years without cause and without stuff, you know, conversation. So
totally.
I firmly believe that when we heard about this happening, this firing happening, they tried to get to her.
I would agree.
And the other piece of this is that she's no longer working with a certain publicist. And that kind of reeks of like them going to her and saying, hey, like you need to cut this out or like you need to blah, blah, blah.
We need to have a talk about this at least, right?
Right. We need to at least acknowledge that, like, you know, you have a voice here. And it's also at a time that Hollywood is really struggling with how to respond to the ongoing crisis. And I think before moving on, like, I want to make clear, we are definitely against like the loss of innocent life and people. You know, I think that goes without saying. And the Israeli,
you know what? These days you would hope so, but unfortunately, you kind of have to like make a stance on something before people then lash at you about something. Yeah, totally.
It's true, and it's. I mean, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one that has a deep, deep history.
Yeah,
and you know, we're not obviously here to solve it on the Guide to Movies podcast. But I just think back to like looking at the whole situation, and I had heard from someone in the industry that there had been talk that people tried to get to her and be like, yo, you need to like calm this down. You need to pull it back. And she was very against that, which led to this firing.
And to her credit for her, not personality, but just her sticking to her guns, I guess, has since come out and been like, I will continue to. So this to me says that she is more willing to fight this fight than be an actress, right? Like at this point in time anyway. But like you said, the issue is the source of information. Like the same thing happened with Jamie Lee Curtis, right? And the backlash that followed that was pretty, like they came down on her with a hammer. And by they, I mean the internet. So like, you know, they came down hard and they were like that. But then it's funny now in a similar sense of there, you know, the factual, the information that Melissa Barrera was putting up was factual or not, right? That seems to have come down with less of a hammer because there was a reaction to doing that as well. And it's interesting because I saw someone comment about it today, or I think I saw something on Twitter about how then you got to look at the race aspect of it as well. It's like, are people not, are being kinder to Jamie Lee Curtis and Noah Schnapp because they are white actors as opposed to Los Barrera, who is a Hispanic actress, right? So there's now so many layers to this that it is quite muddled, and that's the unfortunate part. The sense that I agree with you in the sense there needs to be a conversation between Spyglass, between Melissa Barrera, and be like, hey, this is kind of where we stand. Right. This is where you stand. Is there a middle ground here, or do we part ways? Not necessarily. And, you know, whether, like I said, we don't know all the ins and outs of it, but if there was attempts to get to her and they kind of went on deaf ears or were physically pushed back, then you kind of go, well, what we can do right now is say, we have to let you go, right?
And that conversation very well could have happened. Of course, what we're seeing in the media absolutely, is fired, you know?
Yes, yeah.
But
because that story's cooler, Joe. That's why. That story's way, way cooler. Yeah, yeah. That's, again, the other unfortunate part of all this.
I keep going back to, and this is, I guess, me trying to be very logical about this. To a fault, is that Hollywood is about the money. They've always been about the money.
Yeah.
So to make this change, something else had to have happened. There has to be more to this that we don't know yet.
It's tough to say that there isn't, right? Because and it's the same deal with, like, if you look at Jenna Ortega and you'd be like, if she did love this experience in this franchise that much, you know, why couldn't you make scheduling work? Why couldn't you be like, hey, I do really want to come back for this. Can we film after Wednesday? And obviously the strikes did play an element into that as well. But you kind of fight for those sorts of things if you really do want to do something with it. And this isn't me being like, ooh, I knew all about this all along. But there was something about the release of Scream 6 when I was kind of seeing interviews and stuff. I was kind of seeing like, ooh, are these guys over it? Like, is there an element where, and not because they're part of the franchise or whether it's experiences they've had with Spyglass or whatever, but there was just a feeling I had going into Scream 6 where I was like, I don't know if these guys love doing this. I don't know. And I've seen Melissa Barrera and Jenna Ortega in interviews for other things outside of Scream. And I've been like, oh, you guys seem a little bit more cashed in on this one. So who knows what was going on. And, you know, sometimes it just takes a giant social media sized straw to break a camel's back, right? So,
you know, it's fascinating, though, thinking about where the story goes with Scream 7, because of course we're going to get a Scream 7 regardless.
So, yeah, it's like money, right? Yeah, you don't say no after the box office Scream 6 did this year. So
I think you can treat the end of Scream 6 as a solid ending for done, right? The Carpenters. Yeah. I think you're good with that. I think you bring back, you know, the other characters that were part of the core four here. You get Neve Campbell back in. Neve Campbell's about to get paid, by the way.
There's two actresses' salaries that are now up for grabs, right? So
yeah, they're like, yo, Neve, we need you here. You're going to get Patrick Dempsey back as, you know, her husband, Mark, here.
And after the Thanksgiving response, right, as well, I think it's probably justified that he's like, you know, I'll go to where
will he be busy with Thanksgiving too?
Well, that's a 2025 release date. So
they're taking a year to write the script, they said. So
does he need that long? Eli, do you need that long?
He said he wants to get the story right. I'm like, all right, good. Take care.
Because the Thanksgiving sequel, right, is just Black Friday, isn't it? Like that's we're just getting a 90-minute Black Friday massacre movie now, surely.
Probably. But we'll see where this goes. It's fascinating. I'm not convinced that she won't be back in the fold at some point. She wants to be is a whole nother ballgame. But
that's where I think this lies now. That as same with Jenna, and because obviously they seem very close too, just personally. So that's the kind of the thing now is, you know, is the bridge burnt basically? But how much money does it take to fix a bridge? It seems like a bit of a snarky comment, but
no, you're right.
Some time passes and money looks good. Like a lot of people do.
They'll be back for Scream 11. It's a lot. let's talk about what's going on in Marvel World.
Yes.
We had news break this past week that Destin Daniel Cretton is stepping down as the as the director of Avengers the Kang Dynasty. Yes. And instead we have the Loki writer, the creator behind Loki, stepping in, Michael Waldron, stepping in as the screenwriter. for Avengers: The Kang Dynasty. Have they announced who's directing?
No. Yeah. No, not yet. So from what I read, that Daniel Destin-Cretton, who is a brilliant director, by the way, stepped down to focus on Shang-Chi 2, as far as I'm aware.
Shang-Chi 2 and Wonder Man, I believe.
And Wonder Man, which is going to be a show, yeah. I think. Who knows at the moment.
Yeah.
Bob Iger is going to be like, make them all movies. So I don't think it's a terrible idea, because that was three projects that they were like, hey, these three projects are probably going to come out like within 10 years of each other, and we want them all to be fucking hits.
Yeah.
I don't blame him for stepping down. But then Michael Waldron coming on, who, yeah, did Loki season one, season two. I believe he was also a writer on Rick and Morty, if I recall correctly. And did he have anything? No, it was Jeff Loveness who did Quantumania, I believe, the initial writer. For Kang Dynasty. So the other thing Michael Waldron did was Multiverse of Madness.
Yes.
I kind of like that, because I liked Multiverse of Madness. It was different, and that's why I liked it, because I'm a bit of a Sam Raimi apologist. I like how weird his shit gets, which makes me wonder, would they take the risk of someone who did a very profitable Doctor Strange film, but also did one of the most profitable superhero trilogies of all time, and one of the more critically praised superhero trilogies of all time, do you bring him on to do an Avengers film? And that's Sam Raimi.
I think that's if Raimi would want to, and depending probably on the tone that they're going
with. He's probably a bit of a fuck it age. He's like, I don't care. He's like, I don't need the money. It's like Spider-Man 1 residuals have paid for 6 houses in Hawaii. He's doing okay. but aside from that, I don't know who else I would want to come in. Whether it's still going to be the Kang Dynasty is the question.
That's a great point. I mean, all the reporting is saying that he's writing Avengers Kang Dynasty, and people are assuming that means that they're sticking with Kang. But yeah. I don't think we take that as, written in stone that they're going to continue with that storyline. Also is writing Secret Wars. So I kind of do like that. If both these movies are going to tie into one another the way that they're supposed to.
At least they're going to be linked, right? But then the funny thing with all this connective tissue that is the MCU, all the word about Deadpool 3 is that it's going to connect to Secret Wars, not Kang Dynasty, which is coming first, by the way. Kang Dynasty or Secret
Wars? Kang Dynasty is a year before Secret Wars.
Right. So two Avengers movies a year apart. Are they is it two separate stories that are going to merge into one? Like if Deadpool 3 leads into Secret Wars, then what's going on with Kang Dynasty? I know we had this conversation last time where we were like, what is the MCU? but where are we? But to me, it kind of says, like, I like the fact that they want to keep that same writer, because obviously that winning formula happened with Marcus McFeely and the Russo brothers with Infinity War and Endgame, which I do think is probably a bit of a different kettle of fish. We're really breaking it down, but I'd like to see Sam Raimi come into it, but the way that and I think he's having a pretty decent run at the moment. Matt Shackman, obviously, with Fantastic Four, but this Monarch TV show is getting reasonably well reviewed, and he was the first two episodes, I think, director of that. And he knows his way around a big budget thing, and he knows sort of how to tie together a multiple storyline sort of aspects within that Monarch show. Do you trust him if Fantastic Four's a hit? But you kind of want that decision made before Fantastic Four happens as well.
If it ever happens.
If it ever happens, dear Lord. I think filming last time I read was taking place in January.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And which conspicuously will have run-ins with Last of Us Season 2, which begins filming in February.
Ooh. Uh-oh.
Have you played The Last of Us video games, by the way,
yes.
Joe?
Yes.
That's all we'll say.
Yes. Yeah. Things are about to get interesting.
Get real interesting. maybe for the Fantastic Four, super interesting. Right.
breaking news here. Alexander Payne is directing the Avengers Kang Dynasty.
Fantastic. And you know what? And he's gonna Paul Giamatti's.
Paul Giamatti.
Sign me up. If it's a sentimental movie that I'm in, I'm in. Marvel another Christmas classic.
Yeah, right. Marvel just continues to be a bucket of questions. So we'll see where that goes.
It really does. And with all Bob Iger's comments lately about being like, we want quality over quantity. We want our movies to be entertainment over messages. I'm like, hold up a second, Bobby. You remember when all your Disney animated films used to all be entertaining and have great messages in it? It's not that hard to, well, I'm not saying it's that hard to do. I couldn't do it. But you had some pretty talented fucking people who could. Where'd they go, man? So
he's trying to thread this interesting needle where he's trying to like make the company not look like quote unquote woke the way that it's been portrayed, especially from you know, Governor Ron DeSantis. And but he's doing it in a very contradictory way that is not being received well by Disney fans in general. So we'll see where that goes.
And we'll see if it trickles into Marvel.
Yeah. I this is a whole nother podcast. I just think Marvel is I think their good days are numbered. I think we've seen the best of it.
We need a breather.
Yeah, I need a breather. Let's wrap up by talking about the New York Film Critics Circle winners. This is not always indicative of what's to come, but it is a good indication of, you know, where the film industry lies. And I think some of the big takeaways here, one of them is Best Supporting Actor Charles Melton from May, December.
Huge.
Yeah, huge there. He had a lot of buzz, and rightfully so. I watched it last week and was very blown away by his performance. And
did you enjoy the movie as well? Like, it was...
I did. Yeah. I wanted a little bit more. I didn't love how it wrapped up. But I did.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Oh, we'll have to talk more about that. Maybe. Yeah. Maybe next week.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good one though. I mean, the performances totally. All around are phenomenal.
And considering its subject matter, the way it's handled is pretty like it treads a fine line, but it does tread it well.
Yes, I agree. And then we talked about Devine Joy Randolph from The Holdovers getting Best Supporting Actress here. May December did also get Best Screenplay. Anatomy of a Fall, which we mentioned earlier on, got Best International Film. Did you see Passages?
I did.
Okay.
I did. And I'll tell you what, Franz Rogowski.
Yes.
Great in it.
Him getting Best Actor for this blew me away.
But and that's the thing, like this isn't something that'll pop up in the Oscars, I don't think, unless we get a Paul Mescal After Sun sort of vibe going here. But he is brilliant in that movie. Have you seen it, by the way?
Pastures? I have. I love the movie. I love
it. As infuriating as his character can be, like, he does it so goddamn well. And it was so funny when I came out of that screening, the friend who I went with, we were both like, that's the best performance that's not going to get talked about this year, right? And then New York Film Critics came out to play. So a surprise, but...
I remember seeing that and walking out of the theater, and it was during Philadelphia Film Festival's like Spring Fest that they do, which is kind of like, you know, what we've been seeing so far this year, right?
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah, it was neat. It's like a 4-day event or 3-day event. But I remember walking out, and I may have been the youngest one in the crowd. Just hearing the discussion around it, because it is a little bit of it pushes the envelope in some ways, because it is it's a modern type of relationship. But hearing the discussion, I'm like, man, they really tapped into something here, because it got people talking. And again, Franz Rogowski is just, oh God, so good in this. So great. I'm anxious to see what happens here, if he makes a push. We also get Best Film, Killers of the Flower Moon, which, you know, continues the film critics' obsession with Martin Scorsese.
I think, especially New York as well. Like, I think it's like illegal to vote against Martin Scorsese in New York. they take you out to the field. They take you out to the field and put you on your knees, and then you feel a gun behind your head, and you're like, what the fuck is this, Goodfellas?
vote.
Yeah, vote for Scorsese. It's Ray Winstone. He's behind you. I have a funny feeling that as the Critics Association's awards do their nationwide tour, I think we're going to see a lot of different movies come out of Best Film. I genuinely think this year is going to be a bit unpredictable until it gets to Golden Globes till it gets to Independent Spirit Awards till it gets to the Oscars, where we get a really good idea of who is the front runner for best film. Because I think we'll see Oppenheimer pop up. I genuinely think we'll see Barbie pop up.
I agree.
In a couple of places, and we'll probably see the Holdovers pop up as well, because I think that's getting a lot of acclaim.
Yeah, I think American Fiction is going to make its way into that conversation.
I'm seeing it tomorrow. I'm seeing it, so I got to screen it for it. So I'm finally getting to watch. I'm so excited.
There you go. Yeah, this could be a weird year again, but I feel like we say that every year with like the Oscars.
Totally. Yeah. Like, who knows what this bunch of old fucking pricks is picking, right? Like, no one knows. That's the best part of the Oscars. It's a surprise every year.
Oh my gosh.
You open it up, you don't know what's inside.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Nick, we've reached the end of the day. Well, it's you've reached the end of your day.
I've literally reached the end of my day. You're just starting yours.
Just starting that's flown by.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on again, Joe. Appreciate it.
Of course. Nick at Nick's Flicks Fix.
Don't worry. It's not just you. Sometimes I fuck it up too as well. So where you can see it down the bottom, you'll find me there.
There you go. Nick, we'll talk this week, and we'll see you again next week.
We'll do it all. I'll be back next week.
All right. Talk to you soon.